following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
He's an American icon who fought in World War II, gave you Martin and Lewis, Martha Ray, George Gobel, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Andy Williams, Fried Green Tomatoes, Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride, The Sure Thing, Stand By Me, The Declaration of Independence, People for the American Way, and a few TV shows.
Maybe you've heard of a couple of these.
All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Hot L, Baltimore, One Day at a Time, Mary Harmon, Mary Harmon, The Dumplings, All's Fair, All the Glitters, Fernwood Tonight, America Tonight, Different Strokes, The Facts of Life, The Baxters, Archie Bunker's Place, Silver Spoons, Gloria, Square Pegs, a.k.a. Pablo, Who's the Boss, 227, Sunday Dinner, The Powers That Be, 704 Houser, Channel Lumpteen and 3, One Day at a Time on Netflix.
All of the above with Norman Lear. It's all of the above with Norman Lear. What you do, you know that Norman Lear is just another version of you.
Paul, some weeks ago,
yeah.
You weren't there.
No.
I was invited to come to the Gary Marshall Theater Masterclass, which is a couple of hundred or more young people.
Lucky
young people to be involved with the Gary Marshall Theater and a part of the Masterclass.
Wow.
And I was on stage with Christy. I'm looking at the name now, Christine Lakin. It was some weeks ago. I see the face because she was quite lovely. And I hear the voice and remember the conversation because she was also brilliant. But we had a great time in front of something happens to me when I think about Gary Marshall, who was one of the most stunning figures.
Yeah.
For all the years I was in the business at peak levels, he was in the business at peak levels. I never thought about it this way. I mean, I did, but I never. Gary passed a little while ago, and we were actually rivals. I mean,
yeah, he's doing Happy Days while you were doing your shows, and
yes,
Laverne and Shirley and.
Opposite Happy Days, I think I had One Day at a Time, and which is on now in rerun.
Netflix.
Not in rerun, a Latino version thereof, with Justina Machado and Rita Moreno, and it's got a wonderful family of people. But airing January, the new season, the second season, starts to air January 26th, all 13 episodes, the way things are done now on such places as Netflix.
Were you good friends with Gary?
So interesting. I said this that evening at the Gary Marshall Theater. We were good friends, but you know, geography in California has a lot to do with how much you see of a good friend.
Right.
All of my shows were done at CBS on one side of the hill. On the other side of the hill was the Valley and the Gary Marshall Theater. And it also happened to be ABC's studios.
Yeah.
Pardon me, where Gary did his shows.
Yeah.
So.
It might as well be another planet.
It might as well be another planet. When I think about how much joy I was handed by Gary Marshall and everything he did, and I assume it went in that cut in both directions. Pardon me. I can't get over the fact that we didn't see each other all that much because he worked day and night on one side of the hill and I worked the same days and nights
right.
on the other.
Right. I did a movie with Gary once. He played my dad. In a film, we shot it up at Big Bear Lake, and we became friends after that. And what I always think of with Gary is, it was his birthday coming up,
uh-huh.
and I said, "I want to get Gary. What do you need?" And or I forget how I heard, but I knew he needed combs. He wanted Actifed. Strange list. I get allergies. I need Actifed. I bought him a bag of combs. And I bought him a thing of Actifed, and I wrapped it up, and I went over to the office, and I gave it to him for his birthday. It was kind of funny. It was as if I gave, you know, what can you give the guy who has everything? Apparently combs and Actifed, because he was so pleased. I get allergies, and I need, and then my hair, I can't find the comb, and I'm looking. big bag of combs, and it was as if I'd given him, like, you know, the world. Gary was the best. He was so funny.
Well, when my time comes, I think I'm going to be, I'm going to leave with Actifed and combs for Gary. I finally know what to bring somebody.
To the afterlife.
Yes, to the afterlife.
Actifed and combs.
Well, there was never anybody more personally amusing. Just saying hello. Gary had a comic personality, a voice that amused you just to hear him say anything.
Yeah.
And one of the most delightful minds and personalities. So.
But at his theater.
Don't miss this show. Gary Marshall Theater. And
well, no, they're tuning in now. They're listening.
The master class.
So here it is, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, when I say don't miss it, I mean sit down. Watch this, right? You can't watch it. Unless you knew Gary, and then you can see it in your mind's eye. But listen to Masterclass. Marshall's Masterclass.
Can I just ask a question about Master?
What can you ask? You've done
You're
it.
The Master. I want to ask you this question.
Yes.
So now that we're about to listen to this podcast,
yes,
are we all going to now know how to make legendary hit shows and films? Is that what you're going to give us here?
That's going to depend on the individual. If the individual is listening with the ability to learn as much as one can learn from the man you are about to listen to.
The master.
The answer is yes.
Okay.
Master class.
Here we go.
Gary Marshall.
Hello. Welcome. Welcome. My name is Joseph Leo Bueri. I'm one of the artistic directors here at the new Gary Marshall Theater. We are very, very honored to have all of you with us tonight. It's a very, very special night, and we've been all abuzz here at the theater. Everyone's bustling and making sure everything was clean. I'm standing on the set of our current production, which is Masterclass, directed by Dimitri Toskis, my fellow artistic director, and you will see him soon. And we are in our final week for that show, so if you did want to come back and see what we do on stage live here, please come back. And following that show, we're doing our first big, huge musical here that won many Tony Awards, many times on Broadway. A funny thing happened on the way to the Forum. But tonight we're here for something very, very special. A once-in-a-lifetime situation. We are going to sit and have a conversation with Norman Lear. And before Mr. Lear comes out, I would like to introduce our moderator for the night. She is a phenomenal woman who grew up on television and film and on the live stage. She actually performed on this stage many times. I even directed her. She is... Thank you. she is entering her second season on Pop TV's Hollywood Darlings. She is a delight, and she is the lovely Christine Lakin.
Can you hear me? Oh, hello. Good evening. What a treat this is tonight. Truly, this is just so amazing to have Norman Lear with us and to be able to tell some stories and share some of his insights on his incredibly long career. By way of introducing him, I'll give you a little background. Norman Lear was born in New Haven, Connecticut in 1922. He is an Emerson grad. I thought that would get some claps. He served in World War II. He began his career in Hollywood in the 1950s, writing a sketch comedy for the likes of the famed Martin and Lewis duos, among others. He has a long and decorated career in television as a writer and a producer. He's also a filmmaker in his own right. You might know some of his iconic shows of the 70s and 80s, including All in the Family, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Sanford and Son, Mary Hartman, among others, on and on. All of these shows have reached 120 million viewers per week collectively and have said to have transformed the American cultural landscape, bringing the social and political issues of the day into American living rooms. He is a social activist. He's a political activist. He's a philanthropist. His latest show, which is the reimagined Cuban-American version of the iconic One Day at a Time for Netflix, which is wonderful and amazing. It was rated among the top 10 new shows of 2017, and it's now entering its second season. So if you don't feel lazy at this point in your life, it is my distinct pleasure to welcome the one and only Mr. Norman Lear.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here with us tonight. This is a true treat to be in this intimate space with you.
It was an ugly drive, but it was worth it.
Well, I'm going to kick this off a little bit just because I think it's so fascinating to have such a long career like you've had and to be in a place now where you have a show that has a reboot and is sort of now coming into the homes of a totally new generation. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you and kick this off, what advice, I guess, you've seen the business change a lot, probably since the 1950s, and now it's very different, even the last 5 years. What would you say to young writers who are starting out today?
Go with your gut. I mean, I wouldn't have better advice than that. If you have something you want to say, something you feel is good, something you feel is right, go with it. The best advice anybody ever gave a writer, George S. Kaufman, a very famous playwright of his time, said, write. There isn't any better advice, but with the additional, what is it you want to say? What is it you want to do? What is it you think is funny? What is it you think is dramatic? Go with it.
You've never been someone who's shied away from the political in your career. Has there ever been a time in which that you felt it hurt you, that it was something that people did not want to hear?
I never felt there was a time when it hurt me. I mean, there were times, if you got something on your mind and you're speaking your own truth, you're going to have people disagree with you. But, in a sense, that's what theater is all about. Some people are going to laugh, some people are not. You try to make everybody laugh. And some people laugh and still hate you. when I attended, to make the point, when they did focus groups, you guys know what focus groups are? When the network is showing it, their pilot or, before it's on the air to a group, they call it a focus group to see how the people react. So there may be 40, 50 people in a room, and you, if you're there, and the executives are sitting behind a glass watching people see the episode that you want them to focus on. And usually there is a big dial in the room, and the dial is this way if they're liking it, because they sit with at every chair, there's a little dial. If they like it, they go this way. If they don't like it, they go that way. And the dial up there reflects the general feeling. So they're watching All in the Family. I'm invited to go to the focus group. And they've had a couple of focus groups, and they're back. And I am saying to the network, I've got to see this. How could they be bad? See, I like the show. So I go to the focus group, and there are 50 people or so, and we were sitting behind a glass. They don't know we're here. It's a one-way glass. And I'm watching the start of the show, and I'm seeing the show as they're seeing it. Their backs are to the glass. And Archie comes in, or whatever is happening, and they go, but as they go, they don't like it. They're going... When an audience belly laughs, they tend to come out of their seat and they go forward and come back just a little bit. But if you stand in back of an audience and watch a belly laugh, it's the there's nothing more spiritual that happens in any church than seeing people go out of it, and it's glorious. So I'm watching that people doing that, and no. No. They don't want to be seen laughing at what, you know, the bigotry Archie is spouting, but they're laughing. So that was my first experience with a focus group.
I read, and you can tell me if this is true, that there were three pilots for All in the Family.
There were three. Yes, I made the first one in 1968 for a different network, for ABC. It was the same script and the same stars. Carol O'Connor and Gene Stapleton, Archie and Edith, different young people. When I look back on it, it was, you know, a blessing that it wasn't picked up right away, because I made it twice with two different sets of young people. Mm-hmm. And before, it was Rob Reiner and Sally Struthers.
Very interesting, huh? And did the script change a lot in that
time? The script didn't change at all.
At all?
No.
Interesting.
Not at all.
I don't know that they would make three pilots in this day and age.
Well, each time they thought they were going to get changes. And, you know, the audience liked it the first time the way I had hoped they would, and I didn't. I wouldn't make any changes. But the third attempt, I mean, which was the on-the-air show, at the last minute there was one line they wanted out. And the story of this show and this episode was that I wanted to make it very simple, so not a complicated story, so I could show 360 degrees of bunker. And so Archie and Edith were at church on a Sunday morning. It was their 25th wedding anniversary. The kids were preparing a surprise brunch. So they had some balloons and something was cooking and so forth. But it came to Mike's notice that they were alone in the house. They didn't get the house alone that much. So in a kiss, he induces Gloria to come upstairs with him. So they go upstairs. As soon as they're upstairs, of course, the front door opens. Archie and Edith come in. He hated the sermon and walked out of the theater, and she walked out. And he came in pissed off about, you know, the sermon and so forth. And having heard them upstairs, the kids come running down. Mike is buttoning his blouse, his shirt. And Archie sees this. And Archie says, 11:30 of a Sunday morning. That had to come out.
Really?
Why did that have to come out? Because the way he says it, and 11:30 of a Sunday morning, it makes the audience think of exactly what's going on up there. Well, how about when Michael says to Glory, let's go upstairs, and they run upstairs, don't they have the image then? Not like when Archie says 11:30 of a Sunday morning. That's what they're doing, he means. And I said, I kind of understood. By the way, it wasn't so brave. I had just made a film called Cold Turkey for United Artists, and they had offered me a 3-picture deal to write, produce, and direct, so I was in good shape. So I was able to tell the network, take that line out of the New York, because the threat was the day of the show, they were going to take the line out in New York 3 hours earlier. And I said, if that line is out, I won't be in tomorrow. And I didn't know until I was ready to leave because we were working on the third or fourth episode or something, the script. And I didn't know until a half hour before the show was to go on in New York that the line was going to be in.
Wow.
Dramatic.
Yeah. Down to the wire. There are so many, I mean, you have so many iconic shows. I think they're in the zeitgeist of many of our minds, whether you grew up with them on primetime or on Nick at Night, which was probably where I grew up with a lot of them. you have a tendency to write these characters for women that are very strong. Maude comes to my mind, certainly. What is, even before maybe it was in vogue to do
Edith
so.
Edith was strong.
Edith was very strong. What inspired you to do that, to bring these characters to the screen?
Two wives at the time. and three daughters at the time, later to become five daughters, and one son. But the women in my life, and it was just at the start of the women's movement, too. So as the father of a couple of young girls and a strong wife who was catching, you know, was taken by the women's movement, I was taken by it. And here we are today with Harvey Weinstein. Oh, my God.
It's interesting to me how I feel like things just are kind of cyclical, you know? I feel like things come all the way back around, and I hope to see more characters like characters that you have written for women on television.
One Day at a Time, Rita Moreno is fabulous.
Yes.
I don't know if you see, know about that yet. One Day at a Time, it's on Netflix.
Justina Machado, she's wonderful.
And Justina Machado and Rita Moreno, and... I mean, I just love it. And a daughter and a son.
How was that approach to you? Who came to you, or did you go to Netflix with this idea?
No, I have a young associate who came to me one day and said he was in a meeting and somebody had the idea. What did I think of a Latina version? This is the Latina version of a show I did years ago called One Day at a Time. And it was a big success. How old are you guys here? I heard when you were introducing me, you Emerson. I heard some special something about Emerson.
Got a lot of the front row down here.
So, do you guys? All those years ago, I remember this. I've never run into anybody from Emerson that knew this song. Emerson is marching. Follow the lead. You know that? You ever heard that? No. Now, Emerson, when I went to Emerson, was 30 Beacon Street, or 130 Beacon Street in Boston. It was one or two buildings and a small theater on the Charles right behind it. And the notion that Emerson is marching is as ridiculous as anything... Anything I can think of, but that was the song. Emerson is marching, follow the lead.
Well, I did want to ask you about this reboot of One Day at a Time, because the pilot of it, if you guys haven't seen it, you really tackle a lot of issues in it. You know, it's a family of immigrants. It's a single mother. She's dealing with possible depression. I mean, there's a quinceañera aspect and the fact that there's family tradition, and yet this young girl who decides that she doesn't want any part of it because she thinks it's antiquated. I mean, it's really
she's coming out.
Yes, it's really quite it's quite amazing. It's very layered. Were you really involved in the reboot of this particular?
There were two showrunners attached to the show. One of them is herself from Cuba, Gloria Calderon Collette, and Mike Royce are the two showrunners. And they're brilliant and wonderful. And this was a reflection of her experience as a Cuban American. And, you know, my bumper sticker reads, "Just another version of you." Because I believe we are versions of one another. And their Cuban immigrant experience so related to me, to my memory of my Jewish grandparents and so forth. Very different and very much the same. So it feels like, I mean, I there wasn't anything I didn't understand about it, but it was Gloria's family.
It's really fantastic. You should all definitely check it out if you haven't seen it. Just a few more things, and then I'm going to open it up to the audience because I know they want to talk to you. I know that we'd be remiss if we didn't mention, obviously, Gary Marshall sitting here. And, you two were contemporaries. I was just curious if you had any funny stories or memories of
Gary your friendship. I loved Gary Marshall. We were not good, close friends as much because he was working on this side of the hill and I was on the other.
The 405, you know, mannequin killer friendship.
The fact of my life is I get a lot of credit and I earn some, but not much, what's the picture we made, the show we made at NBC with Steptoe and Sanford and Son.
Oh, yeah.
The British version of it was Steptoe and Son. Bud Yorkin and I discovered the star. What's his name?
Fred Fox.
Yeah, Red Fox. In Las Vegas, so I'll take credit for that. But the show was done at NBC over the hill. So Bud and others are totally responsible for the success of beyond the casting of Sanford and Son. But I get a lot of credit for it. In the same way, Gary worked on the side of the hill. I worked on the other side of the hill. We didn't, and he worked his ass off 7 days a week. I was doing the same. So we didn't see a lot of each other. But I couldn't have admired and cared for him more. And he could have been the star of any show anywhere. He himself was hilarious and unusual, you know, his personality. Anyway, I'm happy to be in his theater and happy to have met Barbara on the way in, his wife.
I did want to open it up to the audience, and I know you guys are probably...
We're having a good time. What do we need them for?
Yes. We don't really, but I wanted to be polite. I have a few more questions, okay. But I'll let them ask a few. Does anyone have anything they'd like to ask or comment on or gush over?
Are you opening up to the audience?
Yes. And Joe has a microphone. He's going to come around and say hi.
Hat. 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 Where'd the hat come from?
The hat?
Yeah, the hat's been... with you forever.
I was writing 12 hours a day or more, and I had the habit of picking my scalp. And my wife, I don't know, 40, could be 50 years ago, came in and threw a little hat on my head and said, "Don't take this off." So I never took it off.
I have a question. I read that you found Bea Arthur on stage in New York back in the day, and that's how you sort of realized that she would be perfect for Maude. But what I'm curious about is, when was the first time you met Rue McClanahan and realized that she needed to also be on that show, and that's what created sort of their relationship? And
I'm
then,
sorry, I'm not here.
When was the first time you got to see Rue McClanahan perform? Because you have such a gift of like casting and finding people that are going to be really do really well in your shows. When was the first time you actually got to see Rue McClanahan perform?
Rue McClanahan?
Yes.
I saw her in an off-Broadway show. I can't remember the title of it. And when I was casting and thinking of a neighbor and a friend and so forth, I thought of her. Same thing with Conrad Bain, who played her husband. And the same thing with Bill Macy. I saw Bill Macy in a play by a playwright well-known at the time, Israel Horowitz. And he was, I will never, if I live to be 1,000, and I would like to, I will never forget him at the first act curtain of this play choking on a chicken bone. Lights went out slowly as he's choking on this chicken bone and came up in the second act still choking on it. And he was hilarious. Anyway... Most of the performers, when Mike Ovitz and the other two guys started CAA, they left William Morris, they were very young, and started the creative talent, creative artist alliance or whatever the hell for them. They used to come to rehearsals and they talked about it, and the actors that came in from New York didn't have L.A. representation. So they found Conrad Bain and Rube McClanahan and Florida, Esther Rolle, all those lovely New York actors. That's all.
Hi there.
Hi there.
I just wanted to say I'm the youngest of eight in my Hispanic family, and there was a lot of arguing and yelling, and whenever any of your shows was on, it was the only time we were quiet because we could all agree on the humor. And then when I later learned who you were and who created these shows, I'm like, who's this white dude knowing about the Jeffersons and Good Times? So I just wanted to thank you for raising me.
Oh,
and
you're
how did you...
I raised you very well.
Thank you. And I just wanted to know, did you do research on these characters, or how did you come up with these stories, or how did you know these lifestyles?
How did I...
know the lifestyles of some of the characters you created? The Jeffersons and Good Times and...
You know, the Jeffersons, Good Times came first, and I remember a moment in the first among the first 7-8 shows, Esther Rolle and John Amos, who were just fabulous performers. They were carrying the weight of being the first parents of a family on black family on television. They represented their race on television. And it hadn't happened before. And I think if I hadn't understood the weight of that, the responsibility they felt, maybe they weren't even thinking about it. But that was a heavy responsibility to be the first people who were parents and citizens and Americans and working family, all those things, and black. Never had been before. So they were concerned about certain behavior that maybe the writers were asking for. And we had a couple of black writers, too. There weren't that many who were available to, or wished to write for television because it hadn't happened before. But a time or two when Esther was concerned, for example, that her 16-year-old daughter, who, black or white, was as pretty as any young woman that ever graced the tomb, when we wanted to deal with boys hitting on her and the possibility... thinking about sex, she was very concerned. Now, she didn't know, or maybe she did, but I would have no way of knowing, that part of what she was feeling, the concern about it, had to do with how she represented, how they were representing America's first black family on television. And not the script and the idea of doing the show because it's a family show and that's what families are dealing with. So we reached a place where I said, look, you guys I didn't grow up as a black kid and I don't know the patina and the behavior and all, but I'm a father and a son and a brother and an uncle and I think families are families, and so I'm going to have to make some of these decisions, and the others are yours. And that's how we got through, you know, their concerns about how to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
What's that?
Hi, it's such a pleasure to meet you. I wanted to ask...
Well, why don't you?
I will.
Okay.
How did the network originally agree to a show like All in the Family when it was such a seismic shift in comedy? Before that, it was, you know, no political issues. It was, you know, mom and dad at home and the kids and family issues. How did they pick up the show? Like, what was your pitch that made them want to air the show?
Well, as I said, I made it, I don't know, I can't ask for ABC 3 years earlier, but they made the show, and his name was Robert Wood, who became, 3 years after we made the show for ABC, he became the new president of CBS. and the Beverly Hillbillies and Father Knows Best and so forth were the big shows on, so a bunch of those kind of shows on CBS, and they were wonderful shows, but they were not dealing with the kind of subjects we dealt with. And he wanted to change things up. So it was he who made the decision to pick up that show that ABC dropped 3 years before and asked me to make another episode, a pilot, this time a pilot. And, but he, you know, a week before it was to air, he asked if, he didn't pick up a pilot. I wouldn't do another pilot. It's on the air, so he picked up 13 episodes. He wanted to make it a pilot after we made it to do the focus group thing again and everything else. And he did that under great pressure. He wanted to do that. He was a great guy, and he made the decision to pick up 13. So we had an order for 13, and then the pressure got to him. But he stood up, and we made the 13, you know, because... So he earns the credit for... I don't know if I've explained that, but, the interesting thing about such things is somebody has to make up their mind. They're looking at the episode, and they wonder whether this should be or not. Now, their viewpoint is somebody on the first floor, 2.5 miles away, who isn't at the run-through or the reading. And that person is reporting to somebody on the fourth floor, who is reporting in turn for somebody in New York on the 32nd floor, who is reporting to the guy on the 45th. So it helps to understand that. So I kind of understood that, and we didn't give in to what I thought of as silly.
Still a big leap of faith for him to have taken it on and to say, we're going to put this on. Because it was very different than anything
else. You know, the establishment, somebody said, sometimes I remember his name, a long time ago, nobody ever lost money underestimating the intelligence of the American people. I think in many ways the establishment has always kind of believed that. If they didn't know the witticism, that's kind of the way they view the American people. And I disagree with that. We're provably not the best educated. We're like 23 on the list or something. But we're wise of heart. And they thought certain things the American people are going to, they're not going to be able to handle abortion. Well, the fact of life is that it exists in families, and if it's not in yours, it's up the street, down the street, across the street. And it's a subject we all know and deal with. So they caught on after a while to that.
Christina, the question over here.
Right here. Hi, my name is Robin, and I grew up, I'm actually old enough to have seen the first run of One Day at a Time, and I was perusing Netflix, and I came across the reboot of One Day at a Time. And I literally sat and watched the entire first series within a day and a half. I was really intrigued. And I have to say, I wasn't sure how it was going to go because I've seen other reboots. And a lot of times it really hits, misses the mark. This show is so phenomenal. And I was so impressed with the characters. I fell in love with the characters so much that I can't wait for season two.
Oh.
But my question is, how did you put Rita Moreno in it, who is phenomenal?
I called her.
She's phenomenal. She's truly the best. I mean, they're all great. All the characters are great. I love the mom. But Rita is hilarious. She's so great.
I love hearing that. I appreciate it. I'm crazy about that cast. I just love working with them and watching them and realize these characters. The two kids, too,
the kids are
fabulous. You know, there's something, it's hard to explain. You've got the words on paper, the character on paper, and you feel something. You don't really know what that character looks like or sounds like, but something happens, some miracle occurs when an actor or an actress walks in, takes your words and kind of puts them on, and you never saw that person before. You never dreamed of that person before. They're your words, but it's a miracle. And Rita Moreno, you know, picked up that script written for a Rita Moreno. But what she makes of it is, you know, nothing any of us imagined. And that's the miracle of great acting.
So you called her.
Yeah, she lived up north, and we knew one another, and I phoned her.
Then we'll come back to you. Promise. And I always keep my promise.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
And she just said yes. I would.
Well, she said yes to reading the script.
Yeah.
And then she said yes to the character.
Hi, Mr. Lear. You advised writers to go with your gut earlier. You advised writers to go with their gut earlier. In this discussion. What do you advise against? What do you feel like is the biggest mistake that writers make today?
The biggest mistake writers make? I mean, not writing.
Like what's something that just bothers you when you read or you see about new work on television today?
Let me answer the question this way. Early on in my writing career, I had writer's block, what is generally known as writer's block, which I used to call shit in the head. So I could be sitting at 11:30 at night with shit in the head. I was writing for Tennessee Ernie Ford. He had a variety show, and I was, let's say my assignment was his monologue, his opening monologue, which is 2.5-3 minutes in a half-hour show. And, I mean, this is true. This all occurred. And at 1 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to the bathroom to throw up. I am so choked. I know from last week that eventually I'm going to get this done and I'm going to sit around a table at 10 o'clock in the morning and they're going to laugh. Ernie Ford's going to read my monologue. With all that, I still got writer's block. I can't get it done until, you know, it's so late that I finally, you know, something in me relents and I write. I saw a shrink in this time period when I had this problem for many weeks. And he said this to me, which could be an answer to your question. He said, you know, you got 50 people in a room, Norm, in a small room, and somebody yells fire, everybody runs to the door, and everybody doesn't, they're crowded at the door, and they don't all get out in time. And he said, if you think of your ideas that way, you know, you want your ideas to flow, but like those people caught in the room, if they're all crowded at the door, like, let them out one at a time. It doesn't matter whether they're short or tall or black or white or, you know, male or female. You'll assort them when they're all out. The same thing is true with ideas. Let the ideas out. Just if they don't flow, they don't flow. They'll flow later. Anyway, I don't think I told that too well, but if you understand it, it is dead on.
So I have a question. Speaking of ideas, can you tell us a little bit about the story of the elevator story in
All the Family?
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, that was you're asking because you probably read that that was the most difficult moment in my experience with Archie, with Cal O'Connor, and his experience with me. The script called for Archie to be in an elevator in a tall building. When he gets in, there's a black dude, Baldwin, what's his last name? His first name, I can't remember. He was just such a good actor. And he's alone with a black dude in this tiny space. Elevator stops, it's on a high floor. Elevator stops, and a Latina Hispanic, Hector Elizondo was the actor, if you know him. And his Latina wife, who was pregnant. They had just seen her doctor, and she's going to have the baby in a couple of weeks. All of that is, you know, as the elevator is descending, and it stops. And it's stuck. And the woman is frightened. And it's clear that she's going to have the baby in that elevator. And that's the script. And I was in love with the idea of the baby being born on Archie's face. And we read the script around the table, and he wasn't going to do it. Impossible. They're trapped in this part space, and he's going to, and the baby, I don't know whether he thought the camera was going to down, see, we were going to see a baby born. Of course, had no intention of that, but we were going to hear the baby cry. Anyway, if you look at the show, and I think it's probably on YouTube, you can find that moment anyway. When you hear the sound of that baby crying and the camera's on that face, well, he didn't believe that could, he didn't believe in that script. And that was the show that caused the biggest ruckus. I mean, we were within 2 days of shooting it and he wasn't going to do it. And there was lawyers and TV executives, and it was messy, but we did it. And anybody looks at that and doesn't think that was, you know.
And that actor's name was Roscoe Lee Brown.
Who?
Roscoe Lee Brown.
I'm sorry.
Roscoe
Lee Brown.
And
yes.
Tonight, up here in the corner, is the other actor, Hector Elizondo.
Oh, Hector, yeah. I'll see you afterwards, wherever the hell you are. I can't see.
Love you, Norman.
The third row. Oh, I know the sound. Hello, Hector.
I'm passing this mic back to you, sir.
What's that? Joe. And we worked together also. We did a show, a.k.a. Pablo. It was the first attempt at a Latin family, in this case, a Mexican family. And with Paul Rodriguez and Hector and some other wonderful actors. Wasn't that a great... Where are you? You there, Hector? I can't see past the fourth row or something.
You'll see each other after.
Yeah.
All right, I have a question.
Hi, Norman. It's Kevin, and I've got two questions. How did you decide to do videotape versus film? That's the first question, and the second one is...
We were doing television. I mean, I don't know that there was... We were doing television. That's what we did.
Oh, okay. I thought you were one of the pioneers of that decision. The second...
Film, when we were doing that, was all motion pictures.
And the second question was, when you hooked up with Jerry Parencio... that kind of transformed everything, and I think really was a rocket ship that you guys did an amazing job with and got you further into things beyond television.
Jerry,
how did that happen?
Jerry, my great partner and great, great friend, he passed just some weeks or months ago. And there wouldn't have been a TAT or... You know, the amount of shows and everything we did had but for a Prince show. One of the great men of the Western world, as was Gary Marshall.
Hello, sir.
Yes, something else before I cry.
I'm right here. Right here. I hope this doesn't... I'm right here. Over here. Hello, sir.
I'll take it from wherever it comes.
Okay. I just want to thank you so much for shows like Good Times. I mean, you basically did my father and James Evans says that's my dad. So, one question I wanted to ask you. When you're pitching an idea of shows, and you're pitching a show, when is it time to give up when people keep telling you no? Like, you
when
know,
they've left the room and slammed the door.
You know, you're passionate
I mean, today,
about...
Today, yeah. There are so many doors to knock on, you know?
Right.
Back then, there were 3 and then 4 networks. I can't believe how many networks and, you know, doors there are to knock on to pitch an idea. Mm-hmm. I don't mean that it makes it easier. It probably makes it far more difficult. But it is amazing. When there were 4 networks, I don't remember ever hearing anybody say, we don't have enough content. Or, I mean, I'm talking about people at home with a television set. They weren't aching for more. And now there are hundreds of places you can go to for content. And most of it quite good. A lot of it quite good.
Right down here.
Hi, you said that you had a problem with Carol O'Connor on that elevator scene. So I'm, how, why? The script comes down, you say this is what we're doing, what, how do they are able to argue that they don't want to do something? I'm just...
Just the way you think they are. I don't know how to answer that.
I don't know.
The star of the show says, I think we can do better. I mean, that happened a lot, and they were right. This is a give and take.
Yeah, but you said lawyers and...
This became
a big deal, and I'm trying to figure out how...
Well, but you know, when you recognize that he had lawyers, and we talked, and we had lawyers, and somebody was going to win this battle... The network was on my side. We won the battle. The actor knuckled. And it was the best thing he could do for himself. Because I think he might have... that was a show he won an Emmy on.
We're going over here to this side. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lear.
Sir.
All through your work, I hear the thread of the theater. And I'd like to find out what your relationship with the theater was with people like Carol and Betty Garrett and all of the people that came through the theater that you had great relationships with and cast in shows. You mentioned that you saw this person in a small off-Broadway theater and you saw that person in this. And it seems like it always comes back to... your relationship, did that also infect your writing?
Oh, yeah. No, I fell in love with theater when I was a kid. You mentioned Betty Garrett. How did you happen to mention Betty Garrett?
I worked with her for a long time in Theater West.
Is that right? I adored her. I got out of the Army, 1944-5. And she had just opened in a show called Call Me Mister. It was a review, but the title song was Call Me Mister from now on. I'm no longer sergeant. I'm no longer lieutenant. Call Me Mister. And Betty Garrett in that show, so unforgettable, as is 2 weeks ago, I was in New York, and I saw Bette Midler in Hello, Dolly. And to sit with, I don't know, 600 people who are utterly smitten so in love with this performer and her performance, and she's feeling it and giving, holy shit. There's nothing like it on this planet. And I just experienced that with her. But that's the way it was with Betty Garrett in this show so many years before.
We have a question down here.
I have an answer up here.
Hi, Norman. Hi, Norman. First of all, thank you for the great work. You've been a true inspiration to myself, and I'm sure everyone else here. And one of my favorite episodes and lines has to be when Archie came home after seeing Cardinal Knowledge, and he told Edith that he thought it was a movie about Cardinal Knowledge.
I didn't understand.
I said that one of my favorite episodes of All in the Family was when Archie came home after seeing Cardinal Knowledge, and he told Edith that he thought it was about Cardinal Knowledge. So, anyway, I just want to thank you for the work.
An episode I don't have any memory of.
I'm way in the back. Don't look for me. My question is, a lot of your shows were spun off.
Were what?
They spun off, correct? They were connected to All in the Family, correct?
Oh, like, whoa, spin, yeah.
So did the characters, was it something that the actor did as the character that made you think that'll make a great show? Or did you already have it in your idea that, oh, we're going to take the Jeffersons, they'll pop up on All in the Family, and then they'll have a series.
No, here's the way it went. Florida on Maud was a great character, and Esther Rolle was just wonderful. And it occurred to us that she would be great, and there hasn't been a black family on television. We had her husband pick her up, and we cast John Amos. So in an episode of Maud, we had a couple. The network was interested when they saw that there was a couple, and with children, there'd be a family. Yes, let's do the first African-American family on television. That's how that happened. Now, I forgot about this. They're on the air for a year or something like that. And one day, three black guys came into my office at CBS and wanted to see they were angry, and they wanted to see the garbage man. I want to see the garbage man. You're the garbage man. Anyway, there was no way of stopping them. and they weren't really angry. They were trying to express something. What they were trying to express was, why does there's one black show on the tube, and the guy, you just did an episode where the guy, he already had two jobs. He took on a third job because he needed the money because the two jobs didn't pay enough, et cetera. And there are black people in this country that are doing very well. Why aren't they represented? At the time, these guys came in and we had that moment. We were thinking about, on All in the Family, we introduced, Michael was always a character on All in the Family, the black kid who was a friend of, Michael was the actor's name, I forget the, Lionel. Lionel became Michael's friend. And we then introduced his mother. It took a long time to think about who his father would be before we remembered Pearlie, which was a Broadway musical. And I remembered, what's his face? It became a scene. And so these guys that said, why isn't there anybody doing better? And we were thinking about moving the Jeffersons, developing the Jeffersons. And I said, well, he's got a cleaning and dyeing store. Maybe he has another one now or three. And then Winona, the actress, the character, came in one day with a song, Moving On Up. And that's how the Jeffersons began.
I'm standing up. Emerson College, class of 89.
Yes.
Way, way back. I have a question. I'm very curious to know what you like to watch. Like, what's on right now? What are some of your favorite shows?
I'm going to confess that I hear twice, three times a week about shows. I have two notes in the car now, and I can't remember either one of them, of shows that people I respect a great deal say, are you kidding? You're not watching this? And I watch this, and I think it's great, and then somebody tells me about that. And there are so many this's and that's, I can't keep up with them. There's so much I haven't seen that I ache to see. And I'm not in the habit of, by the time it's 10 o'clock or 10:30 and I'm rolling into bed and Jimmy Kimmel or something, or I want, or MSNBC because the president has just... I'm not watching as much as I wish I was watching.
I have actually a statement as opposed to a question. One of my most lovable memories of All in the Family was when you had, and there were many, it's when you had Sammy Davis Jr. kiss Carol O'Connor. I thought that was hilarious.
It was Sammy's idea to kiss him.
There's a gentleman right up here. Stand on this side for a second.
You have inspired many, and you continue to inspire many people. What were your inspirations, early television or theater, that helped you ignite some of your independent thought, some of your political thoughts? I grew up with shows like My Three Sons, Bonanza, single parents that were raising kids, boys in both cases, and they did actually hit on some of the points that some of your shows hit on. Mm-hmm. Did you receive inspiration from any of these shows?
I saw, I think, inspiration everywhere. I take inspiration from this evening. You think it isn't a kick of kicks to sit here and, have people interested in what I have to say? I mean, it is so... It couldn't be more nourishing. But I'm also that... I am a forever part of the audience. I drink in. This evening could not be more important to me because I get so much out of it. And I like to think I wake up with that feeling.
Right back up here.
Hi. I'm a fellow Emersonian, and I was excited to hear about our marching song, and I will be sure to bring it back to our campus here in LA.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
And I was just curious, was there a point where you decided, I want to make television or make media that addresses social issues, and
We were, Ed Simmons and I were in New York. We were writing, we had written the first 3 years of Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis's Colgate Comedy Hour. We were writing for Martha Ray, second year of Martha Ray, and we were doing very well. A fellow by the name of Phil Sharp was coming through New York from California and stayed with us for a couple of days. He was an old buddy. And I was being divorced with one child and having a terrible time in this divorce procedure. He had just been divorced with four children. And I happened to say to him, was it difficult with four kids to divorce? He said, no, very simple. All she wanted was my Joan Davis reruns. He had done a show with a very funny woman,
Joan Davis. He did 4 years or so, and his wife said, I'll take the reruns. And I thought, oh, God, I've got to do a situation comedy. My partner, Bud Yorkin, was in New York. This was with Bud Yorkin, so it wasn't Ed Simmons. Bud Yorkin was in England making a film and told me he had seen this show and sent me a copy of a show called... Yes, Till Death Us Do Part. It's over here I get these answers. And so that became All in the Family. And why am I telling you that?
Because it's fascinating. Yeah. It's fascinating.
No, I was answering a question, I think.
Gentlemen, who hasn't had a chance yet.
Hi, how are you? We're a delegation from Oakwood School. And I wanted to give a shout out to Barbara. Thank you so much for hosting us this evening. And my question is, I'm here with a lot of my students and they've been with me in this process. I've been making a transition from directing theater to directing for multi. But the interesting thing is most of my peers in my peer group are all working in single. And they always tell me that I have wasted my time working in multi. And so my question to you is, what do you think the future of multicam is? Because
that's what I'm doing now.
Right.
The next show I'm doing, did we talk about Guess Who Died?
No. More on
that's
the
show.
Right.
You know, we don't have enough of 60 and up on television. So we're doing a show in a elderly residential conclave. Yes. And for NBC and the pilot, and the title is Guess Who Died. So we're just starting the cast. So, this one will be, I think it's the first that I will have done on film, or, you know, with single camera, that is, not film, but single camera, because I love the audience. But with people of these generations, I think for memory's sake and so forth, a single camera is going to be better. So my experience is 100% multiple cameras. I love it. But
it feels like theater, I think. It has a theater feel to it,
yeah.
You know if a joke works right away.
We were looking at a couple of scenes today for another reason, and... I mean, the magic of Archie getting a laugh and holding that laugh with his eyebrows and his earlobes. And I mean, it's a magic you can't get with film. He's riding the emotions of the audience and they're going with him. It's, you know, Dave Chappelle is appearing at 9:30.
Shall we get you out of here?
On the other side of the hill.
All right.
I'm doing something with him.
Oh, are you opening?
Huh?
No.
I don't mean I'm performing with him. I mean I'm hoping to do. In other words, I want to see him and bend his arm.
Oh, good. Okay, I gotcha. See, this is how it's done.
Thank
you. We're going to wrap it up, but.
We are going to wrap it up. We both have microphones.
When are you going to bend
a knee? We played Joni and Chachi right here on this stage many years ago. I just had to say it. We grew up, but we did play Joni and Chachi right here. I wanted to thank all of you for being here tonight. I especially want to thank Christine and the incomparable...
I want to thank Christine, too.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
And the incomparable Norman Lear. There is a reception in the lobby. You are all invited to join in that. But thank you so much for coming. And come back to the Gary Marshall Theater.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you all. Hector. Thank you.
What does it mean, this life, this day and night?
So I'm Norman Lear, and you can find me, should you wish to hunt me down, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at TheNormanLear.
And you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Paul Hittner.
And life is good, and space and time. Give me some of yours, I'll give you some of mine.
Kelsey Knight from the Lady Gang podcast. Happy New Year. How are those resolutions holding up? Our resolution to be awesome is going strong, and it's especially evident in our episode this week, which is our live Lady Hang show. So head on over to iTunes or subscribe to us at Podcast One on the Podcast One app. And please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Also, thanks for all your support and Happy New Year from the Lady Gang.